job down at the local mill. Worked right up, not a mill is ill. I can't pay my bills. The evil man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me a wife, keep a car and a boat. Things got bad now.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you in the air, a listener-supported community radio station, WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. This World Labor Hour is also brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. And I guess we're going to start off with some news stories. Just let the listeners know, though, we have a caller, a guest calling in at about half past the hour from Chicago. And we also have a very special guest, a local guest here that's in the studio with us who we're going to get to shortly. I guess we'll start off with some news headlines. I just want to mention something real quick, if no one minds I go first here. Interesting news from Britain. The results of Labour Party's leadership election gave an overwhelming victory to Jeremy Corbyn with 76% turnout. Corbyn received 59.5% of the vote. And the result is a potential game changer for the Labour Party in British politics. Many of those who signed up as Labour Party supporters to vote for Corbyn will now become active in the party, pushing it to the left. And the other significant result was that Kindle, the openly Blairite candidate, supported by the Progress Group, managed to get less than 1 in 20 of those who voted at 4.5%. So interesting things happening in Britain. Interesting parallel between there and what's happening here with Bernie Sanders. Big difference, though, is that Corbyn is unabashedly anti imperialist. In other words, he's against these wars in the Middle East and all this aggression. That's definitely one of Sanders' weak points, to say the least.
Well, let's see how this goes, because remember, we've had something like this happen in the past with the French president that came in. That was so hard and left.
And then all of a sudden surged right. Yes.
Oh, yeah. And then, well, of course, we know what's happening with Syriza right now as well
in terms of
leadership. So, again, we have to look at this in the context of he's going to try to reform a corrupt capitalist system. Mm-hmm. And I honestly don't think it's going to work that way. He's going to have to go in from the ground and really try to restructure a lot of stuff. So he's got a fight on his hands.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that it's a negative thing, but based on the historical trends of how these things happen with these new figures that come in, he's got a lot of work to do.
Okay. we'll keep in touch then. So, okay. Let's see. Gus, what do you have for us?
Well, you know, every month they always bring out the jobs reports from the major media propagandists, and they always talk about how everybody's doing so well now. So apparently the jobs report shows that unemployment rate dipped from 5.7% to 5.1% last month. Well, It's not as nice. It's not as, you know, again, you know, I like to bring my data now. So I got some data for the people listening to show you that it's not as pretty as you think it is. In fact, there's a global crisis impending right now in terms of a possible recession that's looming. Some commentators have praised this 5.1% official employment figure as a sign of recovery from the post-2008 recession, but this figure is down from 5.3%. The official jobless rate ignores an estimated 3.47 million potential workers who, because of weak job opportunities, are neither employed nor actively seeking a job, according to the Economic Policy Institute. Were these workers counted, the unemployment rate is officially 7.2%. So it's actually going up, because last month with the EPI calculated, it was about 6.8%. Okay. So you're seeing that it's going up. Also, too, the EPI noted Friday that the growth in U.S. jobs is not only just enough to keep up with, is not enough to keep up with the population growth. It wrote that a great example of just how slow this job recovery is going is the flat prime age employment to population ratio. This means the economy is only adding enough jobs to keep up with prime age population growth. Nothing more, nothing less. So again, we have, and then of course we're looking at the one specific demographic are the 18-year-olds to the 24 to 27-year-olds, that group that are, you know, the unemployment rate is skyrocketing for them right now.
Okay.
So again, when they give this data, when we get these reports out, we got to make sure that we break down the real data, and there's more out there for people to look at, but we're not getting better at all, and the jobs that are being created are low wage, low skill, no benefit, public sector work.
Part-time. Yeah, I was going to say this, part-time.
Part-time, yeah.
Yeah, in other words, if you're part-time, you're included as employed.
Yeah, you're so-called. But you don't get your benefits, though, so, you know.
Right, yeah. Right. So, I mean, how many of those part-time workers really, you know, that want full-time work, you know, and can't get it? So,
exactly.
I think that's another element of that one we have to consider, too. So, yeah, well, I think it's great that you're doing this on a regular basis to keep it, because, boy, what we hear, you know, in the corporate media, it sounds like everything's just wonderful.
Yeah. We're
keep shopping.
We're back from the recession.
Yeah, right. Right. Okay, Bob, what do you have for us today?
Out of Seattle, Washington, the teachers up there in public schools have been on strike for 3 days now. So it says contract negotiations between the Seattle Public Schools and the city's teachers union will resume Saturday following the third day of a strike that could extend into next week. So both sides agreed Friday afternoon to continue talks for the first time since the strike began on Wednesday. The union said it had been waiting for new ideas and concepts from the district and got those on Friday. Previous to that, everything had been going on, talks had been going on through a mediator, state mediator. So there's 53,000 students in the school district up there. They still don't know whether classes will be canceled on Monday. So where do the two sides stand? So here's some of the major issues for both sides as of Friday. Pay. The union is wanting 10.5% over 2 years in addition to a state-provided cost-of-living adjustment. The district wants to give them 9.2% over 3 years in addition to the cost-of-living adjustment. Length of school day, the union says no additional time without additional pay. The district wants to put 20 additional minutes on each school day beginning in the third year of the contract with no additional pay. Student testing, the union says the sides have moved closer but haven't reached agreement. The district says both sides have reached agreement. And as far as recess for elementary students, they both agree that they're guaranteed 30 minutes per day. Other issues, teacher evaluations, workload relief of school psychologists and other specialists. So they said they're hopeful. Like I say, one thing that's important here, the union wants to make up ground from teachers. They say they've lost 6 years without having any cost of living raises from the state. So that's part of the reason that there's such a big disagreement with pay here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
And just to add in too, another big thing that a lot of people aren't talking about with this Seattle teacher strike is they're targeting race. The union wants race and equity teams at every school in the district. Their job would be to identify structural inequalities and examples of institutional racism and to address them, because currently SPS disciplines African-American students at four times the rate of white students. In addition, the reality of de facto segregation in Seattle is reflected in the fact that schools on the southeast side are comprised almost entirely of students of color. The three southernmost high schools in Seattle, Rainier Beach, Franklin, and Cleveland, are made up of 97%, 94%, and 94% students of color, respectively, according to the state statistics.
Wow.
So the union has worked this as part of their proposal as well, that they are really trying to understand this institutional racism in Seattle. And I think a lot of that has to do with the political climate change in the city because of the people they have coming in there who have a little bit more progressive ideologies.
Yeah, like Kashama Sawant, the openly socialist candidate. Currently there's a woman from the Urban League running against her. It's like, man, you know, it's all these other city council corporate Democrats and they had to pick her. I wonder why.
I see, I hear Urban League, I get a little,
Okay, you know, education should be a human right in the United States, and students now graduate so deeply in debt with student loans they often never get out. Just found this out, that over 700,000 Americans have grown elderly and now rely on Social Security but are still trying to pay off their student loans. And in over 160,000 such cases, the U.S. government has taken money out of their Social Security checks to pay their student debts. And, you know, I couldn't believe this. You know, Social Security is supposed to be secure and guaranteed, and, you know, I guess this was the case until 1996. Gee, who was president in 1996? Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton.
Oh my God. It's not just those nasty Republicans I see. Another thing that's really interesting kind of, is that Americans pay the highest prices for prescription drugs in the world, even though taxpayer money supports much of the research that develops those drugs. Drug costs increased nearly 11% last year, more than double the rise in overall medical costs. And this when prices generally were up less than 1%. One in five Americans don't fill a prescription because of its cost. Lives are lost because drugs are too expensive. We spent about 40% more on prescriptions in 2013 than they did in Canada. And Canada is the most expensive, Canada has the most expensive pharmaceuticals in the world, after the United States. So we spent 40% more. For a person living in Denmark, they spent only one fifth of what we spend on prescription drugs. And Medicare projects that drug costs will continue to rise about 10% a year. What's really interesting, they reminded me of something that happened back in 2002 when George W. Bush was in. They actually passed a law that the Democrats, you know, went along with, most of them, is that Medicare was prohibited, repeat that, prohibited from negotiating drug prices in bulk from the pharmaceutical companies, you know. And
That's ridiculous. That's a sellout right there.
Oh, and what's even add insult to injury, AARP, you know, supposedly the advocate for this, you know, the elderly and stuff, that they, I started getting those in the mail here recently. It's like, oh my God, I'm old. They basically, instead of fighting for their members to prevent that, they went along with it. They supported it. Why? Because they sell supplemental Medicare policies to their members. You know, it's like, here we go again. You know, I mean, the only solution to this is a Medicare for all single payer healthcare system like every other civilized, industrialized country in the world has. And there's even a lot of lesser developed countries like Cuba, Costa Rica, Venezuela, and other countries. I mean, if these poor countries can do it and ensure all their citizens have access to medical care and prescriptions, there's no excuse why one of the richest countries in the world can't do it. And it just blows my mind if I think about that we went this long without it, and that it's still an uphill fight to try to get anything, even in the corporate media, much less try to get anything passed. But there are movements around the country that have been making a lot of progress, and we're going to be informing you about those here coming in October next month. So. Okay, let's see, Angela?
Well, I just wanted to add in, and you know what, that's probably why a lot of people that can't fill their prescriptions, then they can't take their medicine, so then they're not gonna get well. So then they're back in the emergency room, and it's just an ongoing thing there, you know what I mean?
Oh, indeed, indeed.
You're gonna pay those emergency room fees, and the can of soda that costs $30 that you get with your meal, you know. So yeah, like you say, it's a circulation of capital.
But you know what, they have it all set. I believe the government knows, you know, they know what they're doing. They have this all set so that it can keep going just the way that it's going. Also, I was just looking at the lottery. If you win the lottery, you will not get that money.
You won't get the money. What do you mean?
They had it. They had something on the news. I can't remember. They're only going to give you a certain amount of money.
Yeah.
Because they're so broke.
Oh, it's the state budget.
So if you win those millions of dollars, you're not going to get them.
Well, not in the whole lump sum. Anyway.
Well, I mean, sure. But they're saying that you're not going to get even close to.
Well, why are people buying lawn? That's interesting.
We could do a whole show on that.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, we're gonna take a quick music break here, and we're gonna be right back. You're listening to World Labor Hour on the Support Community Radio Station WFTN Champaign. And don't forget, we're in pledge drive. We have to do this twice a year to try to keep the station on the air and keep good shows like Higher Ground, which I was on earlier with Aaron Ammons. Also, news from Neptune with Paul Muth right before our show, and not to mention our show, the World Labor Hour, because these kind of public affairs programs here on WFT, not to mention the various musical genre programs on WFT. None of these programs you're going to hear on corporate radio. We can guarantee you that. So please, if you can spare anything, please call in with your pledge at 359-9338.
WEFT.org. You can pledge online through PayPal on our website. Just go to Support WEFT on the website there.
Okay, thank you, Bob. We'll be right back. Okay, that was a song from a collection from the 1930s called Leftist Roots, the Folk Revival. And that was, the song was Casey Jones, Union Scab. So there's a lot of good labor songs on there, and also a lot of good songs about that Josh White does about, you know, racial segregation and stuff that are really good. So anyway, I want to introduce us to our in-studio guests. Welcome to the World Labor Hour. Can you introduce yourself for the listeners?
Sure. My name is Billy Kenniston. I once lived in Urbana about 10 years ago working with the School for Designing a Society, and I'm back now to do a PhD in the history department.
Okay. Well, you know, I don't know if I ever ran into you back then, but I know, back about, I think it was 6 years ago or so, this mutual friend of ours, Susan Parenti, had a book that you wrote called A Problem of Memory, which she really highly recommended, and I got it, and it was just, fantastic book. I mean, I was really impressed with it. It's a problem. The whole title is A Problem of Memory, Stories to End the Racial Nightmare. I know in the book, intersplice different stories and stuff, but the main part is about your experiences down in New Orleans, teaching in the public schools and stuff. You want to talk a little about the kind of what motivated you to write the book and some aspects about it that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yeah, I want to say about this intersplicing. We were talking about the school system earlier too. I was working under a teacher there. I was learning from another teacher, a woman named Doris Blackman, and she was. What she was saying to me, okay, so it was a high school in the part of New Orleans, which is now well known, the Ninth Ward of New Orleans. So it was basically an entirely black school, public high school, that, was ranked one of the worst schools in Louisiana, and Louisiana is ranked basically the lowest in the country for education. So we were dealing with kids who really had no one had any idea that they were going to go to college, basically, or a very small percentage. And we had a 50% absentee rate in the school, but half of those kids would come to school. So it was this kind of really intense environment. We would have maybe 200 kids coming to school every day and not going to class. Anyway, and what Doris was saying to me is, this is problems of slavery, right? We're looking at problems of slavery, and you can't make sense of it unless you can understand that. So I tried to write this book that was, I mean, originally my intention with the book was that it would go in and out of different time periods. It still does that, but it's laid out a little more chronologically than my original idea. But there were basically three periods. But the school had been chosen as a site for a community organizing project by people who had been members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the 1960s. So basically, the book, as I imagined it, was kind of these three realities sort of stacked on top of each other. The slavery and the resistance to slavery and Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and then the projects that were going on there at that school at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could kind of see those three realities as sort of simultaneous, that's what I was trying to write.
Yeah, I mean, just and getting towards the other work that you wrote, Billy also wrote this amazing book on Rick Turner.
Choosing to be Free, Life Story of Rick Turner, yes.
Yes, just a phenomenal work because especially in terms of memory and how we write histories, what you do with Rick Turner and using oral history, the interview, the methodology to actually recreate not only Rick Turner's life, but to recreate the social forces that surrounded him at that time. You know, we talk a lot about interviewing and oral history, but when you look at the historical field, very few people rely heavily on oral history. So the way that you crafted the book, you could talk about how you approached this work saying, I'm going to do this oral history and how I'm going to not just make it a biography about Rick Turner, but make it a biography of struggle. Mm-hmm. For the people that he was fighting for in South Africa.
And who was Rick Turner? I mean, for our listeners who might not know.
Well, I let Billy wrote the book. I want to.
I thrown it out to both of you. Okay.
One of the greatest activists in South Africa. You know.
Okay.
So Rick Turner was a white South African man who was a professor at the University of Natal, mostly in Durban, and he got involved in the struggle against apartheid at this moment when the kind of main organizations that now we know about anti-apartheid struggle, the African National Congress and the Communist Party, were really underground, had really been pushed underground. And also in a moment when the trade unions were basically very heavily pushed down as well. It wasn't explicitly illegal for black people to have trade unions, but they were categorized outside the category of employees, so they weren't welcome to make unions. So he was involved in this moment, and also was a moment when the black consciousness movement was taking off. And so as a white professor in a kind of whites-only university, he was supporting the student movement and encouraging them to take a sympathetic attitude towards black consciousness and also to get involved in labor. But to say about telling the story about it and getting people's stories in that, I mean, this time period in particular is not much known about, and also the getting at a description of what white people's participation was in the struggle against apartheid is a kind of a narrow field anyway. So, the point is not straightforward heroism or something like that. I interviewed about 20 different people and, you know, they had different levels of participation in trying to struggle against apartheid and different senses of how much that was successful or how much that was a failure. But yeah, I wanted it to have a kind of a conversational way of writing. I mean, that you can get a sense that there were different people working out different ideas, in conversation with one another.
And that's the strength of the book, really. And that's what we have to do when we write these histories. We have to show that struggle is not simple or static. It's dynamic. It's complicated. And the ideas of the people, like one of the biggest aspects of the book that you see when people try to write about South African apartheid struggle is this idea of where do you fit inside within the black consciousness movement? You know, the ideas going on with Biko and others, like, I'm this professor, and I think the best part of the book is when you talk about his kind of radicalization at the university level. He goes in this space. He's never experienced this before. You know, he's by himself. I mean, he said he doesn't recognize his privilege when he's younger, but then when he gets in this space and he starts asking these very difficult questions about himself and about the movement, Where do I fit into this movement? And when you have these meetings and you have these organizations, you have these protests, these marches, so many difficult questions and complex ideas are thrown out that we don't really see that stuff put forth in the literature. A lot of people just see the celebration or they see the document that comes at the end of it. They don't see the planning stages and the difficulty of going into working through the struggle. And I think that book really captures a lot of that and what Rick Turner was going through, because it was a very complicated time for him. Mm. You know?
Yeah. I mean, just to put in some context, different from the United States. I mean, it's a society, the white population in South Africa is less than 20%, and the Black Consciousness Movement built blacks-only organizations and pulled away from basically they said the so-called racially integrated organizations were not authentically integrated, that they were still dominated by white people in different ways. So to be a white person who is trying to figure out how to do something against apartheid, you have more than 80% of the population doesn't want to work with you. So it was a difficult question. And I think what Rick Turner did that was unique and really beneficial was to articulate the predicament that white people were in. I mean, to really name that it's yeah, it's partly about privilege, but it's partly just that it's not in any way a meaningful way of life. This extreme inequality to live this way is unbearable, basically.
What time period does Rick Turner go through this change of consciousness, if you will, and going through what you write about? I mean, was this during the 80s or?
No, earlier. So he was really, the high point of his life was maybe 1968 until he was murdered in 1978. But
so this was pretty much the early years of the apartheid struggle after the Sharpeville massacre and stuff.
Yeah, it was kind of, I mean, South Africa at that time was making money massively. And so, you know, particularly for white people were just like extremely profiting off of the system at that moment. So to resist at that moment was very, very narrow.
So he had a lot to lose. I mean, you know, you think about it, I think this is an interesting fact that someone like him would even get involved, you know?
Yeah.
I imagine you go a lot into that as far as his whole change of consciousness and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I mean, the title "Choosing to Be Free" is based on this idea, yeah, that which he started to really grapple with philosophically was like, okay, even if we're in, I was amazed. I interviewed all these people that I didn't bring it into the conversation, but multiple people said you can't use the word desert. They said you can't imagine the kind of desert that we were living through politically and socially.
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying, okay, but even we're in this moment that feels like. He has this phrase, one of my favorite phrases of Rick Turner. He says the present always, almost always appears to be permanent. And, so he says, you feel that way, but, you can still imagine a radically different society.
Okay. All right. Boy, I'm going to have to definitely, check this book out, because this sounds like a really incredible story and stuff. You know, now, and also, now we're in more present times. Here we go. Hold that thought. I want to talk about the Americana Massacre when we come back.
Okay.
All righty. Hello, WFT. You're on the air.
Yeah, hey. This is Fran Tobin from the Alliance for Community Service calling in.
Hi, Fran. How you doing? You calling from Chicago?
I am.
Okay. Yes, I had you on the air before, and I wanted to have you talk about the LaSalle Street tax. But I got something from you, I think it was yesterday, about things that are happening in Chicago. I thought maybe we'd touch on that first, if you don't mind. Basically it's, two actions against the Rauner and Rahm agenda. Don't privatize mental health clinics and stop rules undermining Medicaid and home services. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, we're facing the billionaires' attack on multiple fronts. They want to cut any kind of services for people that are vulnerable. They want to cut the ability of working class people to be able to live a decent life. And two of the fronts that are, one is focused in Chicago, but the other is a statewide issue. And one is that the mental health movement based in Chicago has been fighting Mayor 1%. For quite a while around making sure that we have adequate mental health care. A while back, Rahm closed half of the city's mental health clinic. For years, they were kind of
Hello? Okay, I think we lost him there. I'm going to hang up at this point. Maybe he'll call back. I think he disconnected the phone here accidentally. So, yeah, Fran, if you can hear me, just call back in, and we'll continue this conversation. Just a little background. Fran Tobin, he's an organizer for AskMe. And back back about six, 8 years ago, there was a bipartisan bill in Springfield here in Illinois to basically privatize a portion of Medicare, basically these Medicare Advantage programs. And the result of this was that instead of the state administering it with unionized state workers who are very well trained, they basically outsourced it to a private corporation that had basically people that were not very well trained and paid a lot less than the state workers with few, if any, benefits. And the state's actually paying more money to these private corporations. Hello, Fran.
Hey,
we got disconnected there somehow. Yes.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there.
Okay. Yeah, I was, while, you know, we were kind of, a little bit of a break there, I was kind of giving, the listeners a little bit of background on you about, the whole thing. Was that 6 years ago when, this, bipartisan bill passed in Springfield, basically privatizing a portion of the, Medicaid program here in Illinois?
Indeed. Yeah. The so-called SMART Act.
The so-called SMART Act. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just I'll continue with that thought, and then we get back to the two actions. Is basically you organized both AskMe workers, state workers that work for the Department of Public Services, as well as the clients. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Those frontline employees, members of AskMe, that wanted to fight back against this attack that was hurting the entire concept of public service,
mm-hmm.
and the people that they across the table from every day, the people whose eyes they have to look into and talk to are getting screwed by these policies. And the state wanted to privatize much of the Medicaid determination eligibility program. That led to tens of thousands of eligible people losing their medical cards. Many folks didn't find out they'd lost coverage and had been canceled until they went to the doctor.
Oh, wow.
Kind of crazy. And this private for-profit company, Maximus, which is still around, although it's been partly phased out.
Okay, I guess we lost the connection again here. Okay, we're going to try this one more time, Fran. Call back when you can. But anyway, yes, you know, this he was just talking about this Maximus Corporation that the state of Illinois gave a contract to basically administer public services and stuff, and we're cutting people off other, you know, basically looking, one of their main jobs was to go through the rolls and try to disqualify people from receiving Medicaid. And a lot of people lost their coverage and didn't even realize it, weren't informed of it until they went to the doctor. And all of a sudden informed that they no longer had medical coverage through Medicaid. And this company, Maximus, I mean, was actually, the state was paying them more money. I mean, trying to just say that, oh yeah, we're privatizing this and this is going to be more efficient and it's going to save the taxpayers money. And it was just the opposite, you know. And unfortunately, this is part of that kind of scam and everything. Let's see. Hopefully Fran will call back here. I don't know if he's trying to call my cell phone, but that's not going to work. I'll tell you what, Fran, if you can hear me and everything, why don't you, we're going to start talking back into another topic here, and if you can call back, we'll take your call and kind of try to cap off the interview and stuff. So anyway, back to my original thought question here to Billy is, now we fast forward after the struggle of apartheid, because you mentioned earlier about how, you know, a lot of the people of European ancestry in South Africa, mainly Dutch ancestry, some English, were getting very, very wealthy off mining companies, you know. And now we fast forward to, what does it, 4 years ago or so, when there was a group of South African miners that went on a wildcat strike at the Marikana. And here we have, government in South Africa, you know, majority black government, and they acted like the old apartheid government, basically calling out the police that were heavily militarized with armored vehicles and stuff, and they fired into the crowd. And these guys, there's a film of it, and they weren't violent at all. They were just trying to stand for their rights, and they were even leaving the site of the mining company, and the police surrounded them, fired tear gas, and I think killed how many, Gus, 12 or so?
30.
Yes.
28 or 30.
Yeah. And I mean, so basically they went from a apartheid, racial apartheid system to a neoliberal integrated system, but it basically it looks like the same old system.
Well, so one thing I want to offer about that is Rick Turner in 1972 wrote a book called The Eye of the Needle, but it was the subtitle was Towards a Participatory Democracy in South Africa. And that phrase, participatory democracy, what he meant by that is that he was trying to say you can't have any kind of political democracy without economic democracy. So if you don't have people in control of their labor, you can't have real democracy. And so I think he was really trying to anticipate these kind of problems
yes.
coming up.
I see that,
and,
yes.
Mm-hmm. And I guess something else I want to offer about that is that moment that he was living in was really impacted by another set of wildcat strikes that happened in 1973 that was really an amazing breakthrough in this moment when there had been really virtually no strikes for a number of years. And then there was 100,000 workers went on strike in a one-month period in over 100 different factories. And their wage demands were like 100%. They wanted just like double the wage, basically. And yeah, so they were totally spontaneously happened and organized in mass. Like people would come to work, and if the bosses said we want to speak to whoever's in charge, they say no, we're all right here. You can talk to us now.
And that's and that's such a pivotal moment in the history of it, because after the Durban strikes in 1973, you're gonna have just a kind of explosion of more strikes and more rebellions by workers, and they're organizing themselves around a worker perspective. It's something we've been talking about the past couple of weeks on the show, is that worker mandated unions and the creation of these different organizations that serve the purpose of speaking solely for the worker. And that's going to lead to so much firestorm and other international pressure that by 1979, you're going to have the South African state recognizing black worker unions as being representative,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's a huge stake. A lot of people don't understand that comes from a lot of the firepower that came from the workers organizing themselves and just spreading across the country. So that gives you another historical example of when people get together and they actually collectivize and create an objective to fight against, things can be successful. And that's going to lead further along the lines to the downfall of apartheid.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So like I said, this is just, it's a really rich history.
Yes.
South African labor and race and racial history. It's really fascinating stuff. And even though it's a different space and a different demographic, it's still, there are trends that can be studied in terms of basic social history and sociology and groups collectivizing and community building.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, and I didn't mean to minimize that at all. I mean, I guess I was just trying to say about how neoliberalism kind of, you know, snuck in there. And even though you have a majority black African government now in South Africa, it's like the economic policies, yeah. Remain the same, more or less, basically.
Make no mistake, yeah, because let's not forget now, that's how capitalism and neoliberalism work. There has to be a repression of democracy for it to come back, and they recognize that, and now they, you know, they went, you know, the things that happened with the ANC recently,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, a lot of co-optation at the political level. I mean, you know, the repression is there.
Yeah, and what I understand, too, from that Marikana wildcat strike was that they basically, the workers, threw out a union that was representing them because they weren't representing them, and they said, we don't want, you're not representing us anymore. And in fact, I think in the film, if I remember correctly, in the very beginning, when they went and told them that they're walking out, some of the union reps were already in the office with management and came running out saying, you can't do this. And they said, no, you don't represent us anymore. We're out of here. You know, kind of thing, you know.
And that's what's really going to happen to where the workers are going to lose that power that they have built up for so long with those strikes and the power in the 70s and stuff, mm-hmm. is when they go away from a workerist perspective and go into a nationalist perspective, mm-hmm. and go more global and going in line with these neoliberal policies. The worker is not the center of the message or the action anymore. Mm-hmm. And it kind of looks like it does here in the United States, where you have representatives who make decisions for the workers, top down type stuff.
Yeah.
And that's what led to the downfall of the South African labor movement and the intensity that it had following the 60s and 70s.
Yes, so, indeed. Yeah. So, Billy, do I understand correctly you're working on a new book now?
Oh, no, not yet.
Oh, okay. Thinking about it, though, possibly. Okay. So,
we had a caller call in, and he had a question. He said there was a movie in the late 70s, early 80s, that starred Donald Sutherland called A Dry White Season. Mm-hmm. He was a white principal. You think there was any relation between that and Rick Turner?
No, A Dry Wait Season was also a novel. It was written by a man named Andre Brink, an Afrikaner writer. It is a beautiful book. And I guess the thing that I would like to say about that is that, The Dry Wait Season, the story is, the white man is involved with, he pays the school fees for a black person at his school who also works at the school for that son. And that son is caught up in gets involved in the Soweto Uprising, which was a rebellion in 1976 of black school children. And the boy is killed by the police. Mm-hmm. And his first he just disappears. And the white man's first idea is like, well, I'll go and I'll talk to the police and I'll tell them that this is a good boy and that'll straighten it out. And so anyway, he slowly realizes piece by piece by piece what actually is going on. And I think that's also what I was trying to say about Rick Turner is like, what's that climate? How is it that white people sort of maintain their kind of stuck place? And he has these beautiful moments in A Dry Wait Season where it's like, a black activist shows up at the white family's house, to talk about what's going on with this young boy or they're realizing, okay, but he's been taken by the police. And, the wife is really upset because they were having such a nice dinner before he arrived.
Oh, wow.
And so you see, like, the structures that keep this thing in place are at some level not about really ideology, but it's just like we believe we have, such a nice life. You know, we were just having such a nice dinner until we had to deal with racism.
Okay. Right? Well, listen, I'm gonna have to get some public service announcements in here real quick, and then we're gonna open up the phone lines for you to call in if you'd like. Quote from Dr. Martin Luther King: the labor movement was the principal force that transformed misery and despair into hope and progress. And on that theme, this coming Thursday, September 17th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Laborers International Union Hall at 108 East Anthony Drive in Urbana, celebrating the history of labor in Champaign County. Please join State Rep. Carol Ammons for a fun and informative evening about the history of labor in Illinois and Champaign County. Stephanie Sewell, Executive Director of Illinois Labor History Society, will be giving a presentation along with our own Gus Wood. And dinner will be provided, and there will be activities for the children, so bring the whole family. And that's at this coming Thursday, September 17th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Laborers Hall, which is up on that road between Lincoln and Cunningham, just north of 74. So if you go, like you're going to Farm and Fleet, you go back through the frontage road, and that's where the Laborers Hall. It's a pretty good-sized building. You can't miss it. Okay, and also tune in this Sunday and every Sunday for Laborers World View TV from 4 to 5 p.m. on Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6, and live at www.urbanapublictelevision.org. This Sunday is the part one of the film 9/11. Press for the Truth, about the families of the victims known as the Jersey Girls, who in a basically almost 2-year campaign forced both the corporate media and Congress and even the Bush administration to initiate the 9/11 commission. Very interesting film. Part 2 will play next Sunday on September 20th, and following that on Sunday, September 27th, will be 9/11 Unsolved Mysteries. Since 9/11 anniversary was yesterday, every year I do this with these two films. These are two very powerful films. It's really interesting when you see the 9/11 Press for the Truth about how the majority of the families of the victims of 9/11 don't buy the official story at all. In fact, have been very vocal about it and to this day. And so anyway, I guess at this point, yes, Bob?
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that we're in Pledge Drive.
Yes, indeed.
As part of our Pledge Drive, we always like to have our WEF Fest celebration. So tomorrow,
that's right. Yes,
tomorrow evening, WEF Fest 34, celebrating our 34th birthday. Come on out from 5 to 10 p.m. and it's party at Mike and Molly's Beer Garden, right next door, pretty much right next door. And we got some live performers going to be there: Wildwood String Band, Sabine Malamba, Katie Flynn, Hot Hand Luke and the Sound, and Kevin Corey. Gonna have some free pizza from Jet's Pizza. They're one of our sponsors there. And so come on out from 5 to 10 o'clock Sunday night.
September 13th, pretty much right next door, Mike and Molly's. It's our chance to connect with the community and kind of have a free birthday party for everybody out there.
Yeah, let's emphasize that's free, you know?
Free, yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Free pizza,
come on down.
And, you know, while it lasts, and free music for everybody. So come on out and meet everybody here, maybe take a quick tour of the radio station and whatever, and enjoy a good time on us. So.
Okay, you can call in with your pledge at 217-359-9338 or go online, whereatbob at WEFT.org.
You got it.
Okay, very good. Okay, so last, 10, 12 minutes of the show, I'd like to talk a little about the anniversary of 9/11 attacks. You know, one thing people don't realize is that there was a second 9/11. That was September 11th, 1972, in which there was a U.S.-backed, in other words, U.S. government-backed military coup in Chile that basically overthrew the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende. And, I mean, I think, Gus, you might know the figures better than I do, but a lot more people, let me just say that, a lot more people were murdered and died in Chile than there was in the 9/11 attacks.
In the thousands.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of those ramifications or consequences from those events are still going on. And let's mind you that this was part of, like, U.S. government-led assassinations at multiple angles. I mean, Patrice Lumumba and a few other areas.
Congo,
I mean,
yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I mean, like I say, this was a bunch of coordinated attacks. It's like the end of the Godfather movie.
Yeah.
The first one.
Yeah.
At the christening or the baptism. I forget which one it was. And then, like, everybody's just getting knocked off at the same time.
Yeah.
On the same day. I mean, it was so coordinated and calculated. And, you know, a lot of people don't like to talk about that, but that's a really dark, one of the darkest parts of history that led to the issues we're having today with neoliberalism, because the U.S. was setting up their next plan economic situation there. I mean, people think that it started going forward with Reagan, Thatcher, and a few mm-hmm. others, but neoliberalization was already a policy going into effect in the late 1960s when they're talking to these professors about how should we do this? What's the first step to globalizing capitalism the way we need to? And this was part of it.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, Salvador Allende, who was democratically elected, ran as a socialist and got elected, and he basically was making economic changes to benefit the majority of the people. And what really did it, I think, in addition to that, was the fact that there was a couple of mining companies. One was U.S., one was Canadian, that dominated the Chilean economy for a long time because copper is a big industry there. And they basically wanted to they wanted to take it over and put it in the hands of the people. In other words, make it a public industry. And I guess the mining companies were outraged they're going to lose that. But not only that, but when they basically figured out what the company had earned in the past and what they failed to pay in taxes, and it turned out instead of the company getting any money, they told the company they still owed them $700 million. And I guess they ran to the Nixon White House and said, what are you going to do about this? You know, we contribute to your election campaign, and these so-sos down Chile, or, you know, they're taking our, you know, and so that's when it started. And it started with an economic destabilization program similar to what you see going on in Venezuela right now, and a little bit in Ecuador, where they basically, and also the public relations campaign and the corporate media against everything. So, I mean, people need to keep that in mind. But, you know, as far as the 9/11 attacks in 2001 here in the United States, you know, this is a very controversial subject because, you know, I'll tell you what, I don't believe the official story. I mean, I can't tell you what really happened. Nobody really knows. But, you know, I remember the first day that happened. I mean, I didn't know what to think at first, but by the end of the day, I'm thinking something just doesn't add up here. This doesn't make any sense at all, based on what they've said. I mean, what really, I think, threw up the first red flag with me was when, after, what was it, maybe, 10 minutes or 15 minutes after the Pentagon was hit, you know, after the two planes hit in New York City and the plane was, you know, crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, that supposedly they found a perfectly intact passport of one of the hijackers ground after this building had demolition. And within about 15 minutes later, they all of a sudden knew everybody who was involved and who was behind it. It's like, wait a minute here. That's just a little too quick here. And then I started thinking, how many U.S. military air bases are there between Boston and Washington, D.C.? How secure of airspace is Washington, D.C. with the Pentagon, the White House, and the Capitol building? I could see maybe one plane possibly, you know, sneaking through that. Maybe two, but three? I mean, and the third one hitting the Pentagon, supposedly? I mean, that's when I started thinking this whole thing. And I didn't know how many other people, you know, were skeptical about that. And over time, you know, about 6 months, I start seeing stuff on the internet, people posting, that made me think, well, I guess I'm not the only one that, doubts this story, you know? And like I said, this 9/11, press for the true story, these women, these Jersey girls, as they were characterized by the media. I mean, all those victims' families, you know, none of them believe the official story, and they were very angry that that 9/11 commission would not talk about relevant issues. There's even, of course, you never saw it in the corporate media, but there's film footage of them, some of the family members being in the audience, the hearing, holding up signs, liars, you know, and trying to get some of the more relevant questions answered, and it never happened. So that's my two cents. Gus, what's your take on that whole thing?
No. People out there know what I'm going to say. It just doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
The story is illogical from the beginning.
Isn't this the official story a conspiracy theory of sorts?
Well, you know, I'm not, I don't know. Yeah. Some people like to go into, like, some of the kids, like when I was in school when it happened, and you know, this is before YouTube, but after a while people start playing videos and stuff talking about they can see the devil's face and the smoke and all this other crap. Yeah. I'm not going to that kind of stuff. I'm not far. But what I do know for a fact is that we have monopolized and we have created a new colony in the Middle East based off of this. I mean, it was a massive and fervent campaign against the Middle East at different groups of people there following 9/11. And like you said, one of the things I did notice, and I was only in high school when this happened, but when it did happen, they knew so quickly who everyone was. There was already a targeted group already selected the day it happened.
Yeah.
And then all this nasty anti-Middle East, just racist, nasty stuff throughout the country. You had people's stores being burnt. You had homes being bombed. I mean, all these different groups were targeted. And this is what you call a justification for racial capitalism and war. That's what this was. They were justifying these horrible acts. And now the consequences of it, we are now in the Middle East, and now we're getting ready to do the same thing and going into West Africa, going into South Africa, places like that.
Yeah.
I mean, the story just doesn't, anybody that reads the actual story from the United States government, none of it makes sense.
Yeah.
Right, that's because it was a setup. I mean, the government had all and everything to do with this situation.
That's, you know, I'll tell you what, that's for people who doubt the official story, that's a debate within a debate, so to speak, because there's some people that say, well, they let it happen. They knew it was coming. They might have even encouraged it to happen so that they could justify all this. Kind of similar to what the Nazis did in Germany right after Hitler was elected with the Reichstag fire. You know, they basically set fire to the German parliament, found a mentally retarded man, blamed it on him, who happened to be a member of the Communist Party. And then at that point, Hitler was able to push through his, I think it was called the Enabling Act, that gave him dictatorial powers. Well, look what happened after 9/11. Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act. I mean, people don't realize how much freedoms and rights and to privacy and your rights as a, you know, in general were lost because of bills passed after 9/11.
And let's not forget the economic conditions of the world at that point. You know, but by 2000, global markets were collapsing. I mean, it was getting really bad for a point there. Notice that we almost hit a recession in 2001, but then this happens.
Yeah.
You know, this incident happens, and then we enter a period for the next 4 to 5 years of really economic expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like I said, we really have to think critically about these events. I don't know I'm not sure about the whole government knowing about it and supporting it thing, but I do know the official story makes absolutely no sense to anybody that's ever read it. So something's going on.
That's
right.
How you know the government has something.
Something's going on.
They have so many movies, they're basically showing us. Okay, like White House Down.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, how did these people, how were they able to come up into this place that quick and just take over everything?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I believe all of this stuff because, I mean, it goes along with what's going on around here and there. I believe they're trying to show us little things here and there to let us know what's really going on. But the government has the power to hide and cover up anything. So if you did have something to do with it or you didn't, they can make it so that you won't even say a word about it.
You know, it's interesting in popular culture how stuff kind of, you know, I saw a film with Samuel L. Jackson, it was back in, I think, 98, show, a couple years before 9/11. I think it was called Kiss the Girls or something.
Oh, yeah.
About this woman who was a hit woman, and she had a brain injury, and she had amnesia. Samuel L. Jackson's this guy who she hires this down as luck private investigator. It turns out that, she started to regain her memory, but the people that she used to work with are trying to kill her because of what she knows. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that they basically are all upset because all their projects and programs have been cut, you know, and they want to basically refund them. And the only way they can do that is they found they killed an Arab man, put him in a tanker truck full of highly explosive chemicals, and are going to run it into some town having a Christmas parade, you know. Kind of interesting.
I'm saying that we got some examples of that already. The guy that exposed the CIA and Reagan's crack cocaine thing.
Gary Webb.
Gary Webb. I mean, we know that they totally destroyed his life. And then also the doctor who exposed the NFL CTE stuff, you know, all the racist stuff they did to try to discredit him, mm-hmm. you know, because he was about to hurt a $1 billion industry. Mm-hmm. So let's not put it past our government and capitalists to do these types of things.
Yes, that's the main point I want to make here is that, don't think that it couldn't have happened. I mean, what they're suggesting, frankly, I mean, unless it defies the laws of physics. And frankly, what they're saying in the official story, in a lot of ways, defies the laws of physics. Exactly. And if you think, if you want a better opinion on that, listeners, go to, Google in Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. There's almost 3,000 architects and engineers that have come out publicly, with evidence and stated why they say that this whole official story, especially with the building collapses, the World Trade Center are just total nonsense. Very interesting reading. One of the main things they point out in there is that there has never before or since the two Twin Towers in New York City have ever collapsed from no structural steel and concrete building has ever collapsed due to a fire. And they have a bunch of examples on their websites of fires that have raged for hours and hours longer and much more intense heats, and that nothing collapsed. Not to mention the way the building collapsed was a straight down vertical free fall collapse. So I don't want to go too much into this. Right. I'm not a physics or an engineer, but check out their website because there's some really interesting stuff on there that wants to make you think. And that's the main point here is don't believe your government. Don't believe the corporate media. Think for yourself. Look at the facts and don't just be turned off because someone's going to call you a conspiracy theorist. Because you know what? You know, they'd like you to, people that use that term are either misled, are uncomfortable with knowing the truth, or want you to believe that the rich, the wealthy and powerful don't talk to each other in private.
I know that's like when I first came. Remember, Dave, you said, how do you feel about conspiracy? I love it.
Oh, okay. I said controversy, actually. Controversy. Yeah, okay. You know,
the gentleman, they're similar.
Okay. The gentleman who owned the complex admitted that they pulled
Silverstein.
That they pulled Building 7 over there.
Yeah, the third building that wasn't hit by a plane all of a sudden also collapsed later that day in a straight vertical collapse. Yeah, yeah. There are, I mean, I'll tell you what, that's the whole point I want to try to get across here is that, there's so many unanswered questions about this thing. And I mean, you got to think about the source of information. I look at primary sources and you think about the official story. What's the primary source of it? Well, it's the corporate media, but that's the secondary source. The primary source where the corporate media got their story was from the Bush administration. I like to listen to stories about people that are actually there that day. Firefighters, first responders, building maintenance workers, building tenants, construction workers who work in the basement. Go check out their stories.
We're never gonna
go check out their stories and then compare it to the 9/11 commission, it's a total, and not to mention the victims' families, totally different things. So anyway, we're out of time. And any last words, anyone?
I was looking on Facebook yesterday and they showed, one of the explosions of the 9/11 at the Twin Towers and it was like gruesome. Oh my goodness. People were running, police. I mean, there was nowhere really you were safe at, just in about 10 blocks of that place, maybe 12 blocks.
Yeah, that's some pretty dramatic footage, when that happened and stuff. And, there's so many other interesting stories about that day, including that plane that went down in Pennsylvania. That's quite interesting. I've talked to people that lived in Cleveland that said that their local news media had some interesting coverage of that before. I mean, there's so many things on there that, I mean, when you start looking at some of this stuff, I mean, you got to be careful, though, because there's a lot of, I think, intentional disinformation out there to try to discredit any kind of scrutiny of the story. I mean, everyone from, oh, yes, 9/11 was done by shape-shifting aliens. I think it was that guy David Icke's or whatever.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, and all sorts of crazy stuff. But, of course, a lot of people will say that, you know, if you question a story, you believe something like that. No, that's not true at all.
But one thing that we do want to end with, though, we want to talk about definitely the effects of what we're, where we're at. If you, when we just break down not only the data, but just the everyday lives of the people, the narratives, what you see is that 9/11, since 9/11, you have greater oppression of people, particularly African Americans, particularly working and poor people. And also you have not, and this isn't just, national, but this is also global.
Yes.
In the persecution, oppression, and repression of people of color and exploitation of their labor. I mean, since 9/11, I mean, it has skyrocketed since 9/11.
Indeed.
So we look at it from that standpoint.
Okay.
I wanted to add one piece from South Africa. There was a novelist named J.M. Coetzee, another interesting Afrikaner. He wrote a book called Waiting for the Barbarians in the 1970s, talking about the apartheid state. And he said recently, at that time, I thought that the people who ran the apartheid government were moral barbarians, but now I see that they were just ahead of their time.
Oh, what a, that's a great statement to end on here. Yes, Bob.
Yeah, we want to thank Nick for his generous pledge.
Oh, okay.
Our friend Nick, always.
All right, well, thank you so much, Nick. And anyway, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on the Supported Community Radio Station W15 Champaign. Until next, stay tuned for the Union Edge. And until next week, be safe. Power to the people. Take care. Okay.